If you're a science geek like me and you like books too, there's one end of year ritual that you can always look forward to on our program. And I don't mean spiking the eggnog. I mean making that end of the year book list. And now is the time to celebrate all the science books that made you think, made you laugh, interrupted other people's concentrations. Yeah, do you do this by blurting out, "You aren't going to believe this," and then you upset the person who's trying to do a crossword puzzle or something like that? It works for me all the time, or it doesn't work, especially for books like this. There was Ginger Strand's The Brothers Vonnegut, about Kurt Vonnegut's connection to weather research. Neal Stephenson's millennia-spanning sci-fi epic Seven Eves. I really like that one. Sherry Turkle's look at digital age communication in a reclaiming conversation. And I know everybody out there has their list, so why not share it? Give us a call with your top science read for 2015 at 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-8255. Or you can tweet us at SciFry, and maybe you can help out a fellow listener find that perfect gift. But we're going to get the conversation going, kick it off with two of our most omnivorous is good for devouring books, I think. But don't you think, Maria? Maria Popova is the editor and founder of BrainPickings.org. She joins us here in our New York studios. Always good to have you back.
Always good to be back.
Deborah Blum is the director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT, the author of The Poisoner's Handbook. She joins us today from Cambridge. Great to have you back, Deborah.
It's great to be here.
Any more poisoning books this year on your list?
I'm writing a poisoning epic book. No one will ever come near me once I finish it, I'm afraid.
You do have that record, you know. let's start then, Deborah, with your criteria. What science book got to make your book end list this year?
You know, I thought this was a wonderful year for books about science, but the book I'm going to talk about first is not what you might think of as a classic science book. It's H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, which is just an amazing book, you know, beautiful and chilling and haunting to read. It's actually it's the story of a daughter grieving the loss of her father and in a very depressive sense, but she copes by becoming a falconer, and she trains a hugely wild, very dangerous kind of hawk called a goshawk. And the book uses both that relationship, right, to explore natural history, this amazing bird, the way we relate to the natural world around us. I love the book. It's about how we cope with death and how we cope with life. And it does that so beautifully because life itself needs coping with. But it makes you see this in this amazing picture of the natural world. It's just an incredible, mesmerizing book.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Deborah Blum and Maria Popova about this year's best books list. Let me ask you, Maria, for your first pick, and then I want to ask about what makes a good science book, why it fits into your criteria as a great science book.
So I'll answer that first because it actually frames why my first pick is my first pick. There's a lovely 1969 interview with E.B. White in which he says that one must write up to children and not down, and anybody who writes down to them is wasting their time. And I think what's true of great children's books is true of great science books. They ought to do three things, I think, for the reader, which is to explain, to enchant, and to elevate. They need to tell you what something is and why it matters, get you captivated to care enough about it, and then to take pleasure in understanding it, and then leave you in a higher state of understanding whatever aspect of the world the book tried to explain. So my first pick is On the Move by the late, great, sorely missed friend of sci-fi, friend of Brain Pickings, friend of the world, Oliver Sacks. To me, Oliver Sacks was a Copernicus of the mind and a Dante of medicine who turned the case study into a poetic form. And he did that because his life and work were one. They sprang from the same source. So his autobiography is so much more than this limited genre term implies. And to me, it's really a dialogue with time on the scales of the personal, the cultural, and the civilizational. We see him going from world champion weightlifter to world-renowned neurologist. We see him as a young gay man in the 1960s trying to find true love, very different from our marriage equality world. And then we see him on the beaches of City Island, where he lived for a long time, watching the horseshoe crabs mate just like they did 400 million years ago on the shores of Earth's primordial seas. And he talks about all of that beautifully and enchantingly, but also very much as a scientist.
Yeah, and he exposes parts of himself about his, who he was that we never had any idea about. And it is a great book. We have to go to the break, and I don't want to start another conversation, but he is somebody we sorely miss, certainly at this time of the year when we think about gift-giving and books.
He was a giant.
Deborah, do you feel the same way about Oliver?
Yes, I do. I think that he inspired a whole generation of both science writers and lovers of science to see the world in a different way and to see it in a more intricately knit, fascinating, connected way. And that's actually one of my criteria for a great science book, is that you finish it. And it reminds me of what you said earlier, Ira, you know, when you interrupt someone because did you know this? But it changes. I do that all the time. But it changes
so
the way you... We would be terrible playing games together, right? But it changes the way you see the world. You think a little differently. And a good science book does that in a way that makes you feel welcome into that conversation. Let's talk about this together.
All right. We're going to continue that conversation with Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, Maria Popova, editor and founder of brainpickings.org. And we want to hear from you. Give us some suggestions, 844-724-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's our annual end-of-the-year book party, so to speak. What are the great books of 2015 with Deborah Blum and Maria Popova? Our number, 844-724-8255. We're having some suggestions coming in even as we speak, so let's go to them right now. Let's go to Rob in Portage, Michigan. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Hey there. Go ahead.
I read a book early this year called The Martian, which then they made into a fabulous movie.
It's a book
about engineering and about science, about solving problems.
You mean The Martian?
Yes.
Yeah. It was a great book, but you know, we have to disqualify because it came out last year. It feels like this year.
And yes, it's when the paperback
and the movie and all that kind of stuff made it. But we'll allow you to suggest it as a great read because I love the book. I love that we had the author on. It was great. Deborah, pick number two. Give us your second pick.
Well, my second pick is obviously I'm going to sound like I'm doing a theme of strange creatures here, but my second pick is a book called The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery. And it's kind of a really surprising book, but what it does is it looks at consciousness. So it takes this little known deep sea species that we all tend to think of, I don't know if we all do, but many people imagine in a kind of Jules Verne monster sense. Mm-hmm. And it makes it into, not even makes it, it allows you to see the octopus as a creature with relationships and reactions, affection, social awareness of itself and others. There is this one octopus in the story that for some reason hates one of the people in the aquarium where it lives. And literally years later, when this man comes back, it squirts him across the room, right? Just looks, can see his face and say, oh, yeah, that's that person I really hate, right? And so it allows you to realize how complex they are. And in the course of doing it, and it's just beautifully written, it asks, what's self-awareness and what's recognition of others and how do we define that? And it moves you away from that idea that those kind of reactions are strictly human. So in that sense, it kind of opens up the natural world.
It's an octopus with an attitude.
Yes, I
Jules Verne was right in 20,000 Leagues.
Yeah, right. If that had been a boat, it would have been in trouble.
Yeah, you know, and we have special fondness for octopuses and all kinds of cephalopods on Science Friday. We have cephalopods.
As the Oliver Sacks.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I could get into a story about him coming on one week, many, many years ago when he came on. We told him we couldn't interview him for the whole hour, because we had a guy searching for giant squid out in the South Pacific. And he said, can I stay on? This is my favorite subject, he said. And we didn't believe him. We didn't believe him. And then, so we were talking to him early in the week. And on Friday, he shows up in the studio with a cephalopod T-shirt. And he's got two giant squids, one in each hand, squeezing on the rubber little squid, saying, I'm ready for this show. It was great, and he was more eager to get done with his interview so he could hear us talking to the guy who was looking in by satellite phone for the giant squid. Anyhow, okay, Maria, what's your next pick?
It's about another extraordinary scientist. It's called Alexander von Humboldt and the Invention of Nature by design historian Andrew Wolf, whom you had on the show a couple months ago. And it's a kind of cultural resurrection project that links much of our contemporary understanding of life to this remarkable man who was once the most famous scientist of his time and a huge influence on Darwin and Mariah Mitchell and Goethe and Thoreau, and who's now pretty much forgotten. But he pioneered the idea that life isn't this hodgepodge of disjointed elements and phenomena, but an intricate web of connectedness, of interconnectedness, where everything is in constant dynamic interaction with everything else. To Deborah's point earlier, this is very much the kind of book that makes you appreciate that and appreciate how this forgotten hero really paved the way for the modern environmental movement. And in sort of dusting him off and relating him to today, Andrew Wolf is performing, I think, a tremendous act of public service.
Yeah, because no one in America, you ask anybody that they've ever heard of him, probably never.
Well, Chicago's Humboldt Park is probably as close as
we all know a Humboldt something.
Yeah,
but we didn't know where it came from or who it was named after. And it was, I agree with you, it's one of my great
And he
books
also
of the year.
He popularized science by seeing culture in the same integrated way. So he related science to art and philosophy and poetry and history in a way that was pretty much unprecedented before. So even our science communication can be traced back to Humboldt.
Yeah, he's sort of a Richard Feynman in that sense.
Well, Richard Feynman is a Humboldt in that sense.
Okay. Well, I'll take that. Let's see if we can go to the phones, get another suggestion or two. Let's go to Barbara in Maryland. Hi, Barbara.
Do I turn the phone off now?
Yes.
I mean the radio off now?
Turn the radio off. There's an old song.
Okay, it's off now.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. This isn't the same kind of science, but it's really interesting. It's called Ghost Boy. A boy goes home from school, he's 12 years old, has some kind of virus that leaves his body rigid, and he can't speak, he can't do anything. And he's been abused by different caretakers and all that. But his parents, you know, take care of him. So 12 years later, I believe, they have this new invention where you can use your eyes to use an alphabet board. And he passed the test because that's one thing that still moved. And they found out that this boy was brilliant inside of him just because of this invention. And he went on to be able to use a computer and fix computers that other people had problems with, and just really a brilliant one. But just because of this one invention, it opened the whole world to this boy that couldn't, his body was rigid and he couldn't speak. So I think it comes under science, so I don't know what you feel.
It's sort of a mini Stephen Hawking story, you know, where Stephen Hawking was able to continue his career because they kept inventing new machines that he could use. It's called Ghost Boy. Have you ever heard of Maria?
No.
No? Deborah? No.
No, I don't know. But I think, you know, one of the things that's so interesting is that it reminds us of all these ways that the new technologies that we're coming up with now are like saviors for some people, right? They enable all kinds of interesting ways allowing you to communicate or move the body or connect in different ways. It's a whole fascinating new field.
Mm-hmm. Maria, your next pick.
I have Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs by Harvard cosmologist and particle physicist Lisa Randall, whom you've also had on the show earlier this year. On the surface, well, really on the cover, the book is about this really original theory that links dark matter to the extinction of the dinosaurs by proposing that 66 million years ago, a minor perturbation in the outermost solar system caused by dark matter dislodged a comet out of orbit and hurled it toward Earth and ended up as the meteoroid that killed the dinosaurs and three quarters of living creatures. But the theory, I think, is just a clever guise to tell this larger story of how the universe evolved and even what made our own existence possible, because lest we forget, had the dinosaurs not perished, large mammals wouldn't have come to dominate Earth and we wouldn't be here to make sense of the origin of the universe. And in a way, this book is the cultural progeny of Humboldt, because it's very much concerned with exposing how these seemingly unrelated events across space and time are actually profoundly related to everything we experience as life, weaving together physics, biology, geology, ecology, and even the social sciences. And I have to say, this is one of those books that very much talks up to you, that takes you for an intelligent peer and, to borrow Oliver Sacks' wonderful term, for a thinking animal, which I think is just a lovely compliment to the reader.
You know, what also struck me when Dr. Randall was on the program is I mentioned to her that it's also a journey of a scientist outside of her own field.
Yeah, she had to learn about these other disciplines.
And
yeah.
she and her delight in discovering there were other things out there that she could enjoy as much as she was doing, you know, what she does about her physics.
Well, yeah, but that's also an undercurrent of the book itself. The sheer amount of humanity and serendipity and messiness that goes along with all the rigor of how science is done, from the two scientists who discovered cosmic microwave background radiation by cleaning pigeon poop off their telescopes, to the crazy 30-year detective story to prove that it was indeed a meteoroid that killed the dinosaurs, and then following a global scavenger hunt to find its location. There's all of this kind of excitement and thrill and human, just, you know, humanity around the science.
Yeah, you know, Deborah, I love books which, you know, start out with a single topic, but then they branch out so widely that you get to learn so much more about other things that, you know, that are meaningful, but, you know, they just take sidetracks and they're wonderful to learn about also.
I do, too. And one of the books on my list is Rain by Cynthia Barnett, which just takes the topic of rain and makes it exploration of the entire universe. It, you know, actually has this lovely beginning. And when she looks at Ray Bradbury imagining this blue rain on Mars, speaking of the Martians, and then goes back to how do we decipher the first rains and drought and is there rain in outer space? And it's sort of a poetic cultural exploration of everything through the lens of rain.
Mm-hmm. And Plucked? Familiar with that book?
Yes, yeah. I love Plucked. Yeah. I'm so excited to be talking about it, which I know is going to make me sound weird. But it's
too late for that.
I sense another weird creature.
I just love it. No, Plucked is not chickens, actually. It's a history of hair removal, and it's written by an academic, Rebecca Herzig. And it's such a fascinating book because it takes, again, this one subject, our obsession with hair on the human body, and starts when we first started seeing it as a kind of class issue, you know. Mm-hmm. The higher classes have less hair, and then it runs through all the different sort of technologies and chemistries of removing hair, and it has this amazing chapter. This is where I would have interrupted your game, Ira, in which it's called, I think, Soft White Velvety Skin, and it's looking at young, affluent white women in the early 20th century who would go to X-ray salons because they would go to be irradiated so that their skin almost all over their body would be hair-free. And I'm reading this, and it was really one of those first, I had no idea kind of moments,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But it's also a reminder, and I think it's important to remember this too, that we get so gee-whizzy about these new technologies without fully understanding them. And so we repeat this pattern of putting ourselves at risk, which is one of the things I like about history of science. Yeah. In the same way that Maria references dusting off important and influential sciences, I think when we go back, we get to dust off important and influential mistakes.
I got to dust off a break here. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about our favorite books of the year with Deborah Blum and Maria Popova. Let's go to the phones. I think we have some interesting, let's see who we go. Oh, yeah. Let's go to Bill in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Bill.
Hello, sir.
Yes. Welcome.
Hey. Basically I think it was The Material Explainer by Randall Munroe.
The Thing Explainer.
Sure.
Love that book.
Yeah, I've already got What If memorized, first one.
I've already given two away as gifts to kids because it's that's a great. What did you like most about it, Bill?
I know it sounds funny, but the clarity of it in the, because I am finding myself teaching GED to folks at English as a Second Language as well as folks that didn't graduate high school, and it's perfect.
Mm.
It's like makes all the fancy terms so much less scary.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
And gives science to folks that are scared of it.
Yeah, thanks for that suggestion. It is a good book. Maria, are you familiar with that book?
I am. I very much love Randall Munroe's work, and last year's book, What If, is wonderful. I mean, as far as blog-turned-book adaptations go, which generally are not great, this is fantastic.
Yeah, and Deborah, you had something?
Yes, I love Thing Explainer because as a writer, you start really thinking about, well, how do I tell these stories of science, right? He does such an amazing job of taking 1,000 common words and applying them to all sorts of complicated ideas. It is really fun.
What I also loved about the book, being a geek and like they know how things work, I like the size of the book. I like the fact that it loses a lot on a Kindle. If you read this book, it's an oversized, big book. It feels great to go through the pictures. There are pictures that fold out from the center of it. It's the kind of book made the way it used to make books, you know? And
yes.
You can't read this on a Kindle, really. There,
agreed.
I said it.
Although, if I've got a minute, one of my other books is a very little book,
please.
Which is...
I've got a minute. That's about it. Go ahead.
The Hunt for Vulcan by Tom Levinson. And I mean, it's almost a stocking stuffer size book, but it's a beautiful little book proving that I'm interested in other things besides strange animals. It's about a planet that we once thought existed called Vulcan. And scientists in the 19th century were so convinced that it existed that they actually reported sightings of it, even through telescopes. But it never existed. And it was disproved by Albert Einstein when he began to explain his theory of general relativity. So it's a wonderful look at this mythical planet and also how science works, I think.
Yeah, I like Tom Levinson. I think we missed that book. Let's see if we get The Hunt for Vulcan. Any last word? You got 15 seconds, Maria.
I have... let's go with this one. I have The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage by Sidney Padua, who had also on the show. And it's the story of how these two eccentric Victorian geniuses, Ada Lovelace, the first computer programmer, and lovable curmudgeon Charles Babbage, invented the first computer, the analytical engine. But what's really wonderful about the book is that although it's a comic book, it's really a masterwork of scholarship and footnotes.
All right, there you have it. Deborah Blum and Maria Popova, thank you both for joining us, picking out those books. And you can see all of their selections on our website at sciencefriday.com/books2015. And while you're there, you can leave your own recommendations in the comments sections. And while you're on our website, you can find a story you have to see to believe. This is stunning illustrations of colorful fish species in the Salish Sea. They're incredibly lifelike. I swear they look like they're swimming off the screen. And they're not photos. They're drawings. It's unbelievable. You got to check them out. sciencefriday.com/fish drawings. Have a great holiday weekend leading up to big holidays coming up. Have a safe weekend while you're out there shopping. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.